Section 10 of To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. This recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Part 2. Time Passes. Chapter 1.
"Well, we must wait for the future to show," said Mr. Banks, coming in from the terrace. "It's almost too dark to see," said Andrew, coming up from the beach.
"One can hardly tell which is the sea and which is the land," said Prue.
"Do we leave that light burning?" said Lily, as they took their coats off indoors.
"No," said Prue, "not if everyone's in."
"Andrew," she called back, "just put out the light in the hall."
One by one the lamps were all extinguished, except that Mr. Carmichael, who liked to lie awake a little reading Virgil, kept his candle burning rather longer than the rest.
Chapter 2. So with the lamps all put out, the moon sunk, and a thin rain drumming on the roof, a downpouring of immense darkness began. Nothing, it seemed, could survive the flood, the profusion of darkness, which, creeping in at keyholes and crevices, stole round window blinds, came into bedrooms, swallowed up here a jug and basin, there a bowl of red and yellow dahlias, there the sharp edges and firm bulk of a chest of drawers. Not only was furniture confounded, there was scarcely anything left of body or mind by which one could say, "This is he," or "This is she." Sometimes a hand was raised as if to clutch something or ward something off, or somebody groaned, or somebody laughed aloud as if sharing a joke with nothingness. Nothing stirred in the drawing-room or in the dining-room or on the staircase. Only through the rusty hinges and swollen sea-moistened woodwork, certain airs, detached from the body of the wind—the house was ramshackle, after all—crept round corners and ventured indoors. Almost one might imagine them, as they entered the drawing-room, questioning and wondering, toying with the flap of hanging wallpaper, asking, would it hang much longer? When would it fall? Then, smoothly brushing the walls, they passed on musingly, as if asking the red and yellow roses on the wallpaper whether they would fade, and questioning, gently, for there was time at their disposal, the torn letters in the waste paper basket, the flowers, the books, all of which were now open to them, and asking, were they allies, were they enemies, how long would they endure? So some random light directing them with its pale footfall upon stair and mat, from some uncovered star, or wandering ship, or the lighthouse even, with its pale footfall upon stair and mat, the little heirs mounted the staircase and nosed round bedroom doors. But here, surely, they must cease. Whatever else may perish and disappear, what lies here is steadfast. Here one might say to those sliding lights, those fumbling heirs that breathe and bend over the bed itself, here you can neither touch nor destroy. Upon which, wearily, ghostlily, as if they had feather-light fingers and the light persistency of feathers, they would look once on the shut eyes and the loosely clasping fingers, and fold their garments wearily and disappear. And so, nosing, rubbing, they went to the window on the staircase, to the servants' bedrooms, to the boxes in the attics, descending, blanched the apples on the dining-room table, fumbled the petals of roses, tried the picture on the easel, brushed the mat and blew a little sand along the floor. At length, desisting, all ceased together, gathered together, all sighed together, all together gave off an aimless gust of lamentation, to which some door in the kitchen replied, swung wide, admitted nothing, and slammed to. Here Mr. Carmichael, who was reading Virgil, blew out his candle. It was past midnight. Chapter 3. But what, after all, is one night? A short space, especially when the darkness dims so soon, and so soon a bird sings, a cock crows, or a faint green quickens, like a turning leaf in the hollow of the wave. Night, however, succeeds to night. The winter holds a pack of them in store,
and deals them equally, evenly, with indefatigable fingers. They lengthen, they darken. Some of them hold aloft clear planets, plates of brightness. The autumn trees, ravaged as they are, take on the flash of tattered flags kindling in the gloom of cool cathedral caves, where gold letters on marble pages describe death in battle, and how bones bleach and burn far away in Indian sands. The autumn trees gleam in the yellow moonlight, in the light of harvest moons, the light which mellows the energy of labour, and smooths the stubble, and brings the wave-lapping blue to the shore. It seemed now as if, touched by human penitence and all its toil, divine goodness had parted the curtain and displayed behind it, single, distinct, the hair erect, the wave falling, the boat rocking, which, did we deserve them, should be ours always. But alas, divine goodness, twitching the cord, draws the curtain. It does not please him. He covers his treasures in a drench of hail, and so breaks them, so confuses them, that it seems impossible that their calm should ever return, or that we should ever compose from their fragments a perfect whole, or read in the littered pieces the clear words of truth. For our penitence deserves a glimpse only, our toil respite only. The nights now are full of wind and destruction. The trees plunge and bend, and their leaves fly helter-skelter until the lawn is plastered with them, and they lie packed in gutters and choke drain-pipes and scatter damp paths. Also the sea tosses itself and breaks itself, and should any sleeper fancying that he might find on the beach an answer to his doubts, a sharer of his solitude, throw off his bedclothes and go down by himself to walk on the sand, no image with semblance of serving and divine promptitude comes readily to hand, bringing the night to order and making the world reflect the compass of the soul. The hand dwindles in his hand, the voice bellows in his ear. Almost it would appear that it is useless in such confusion to ask the night those questions as to what, and why, and wherefore, which tempt the sleeper from his bed to seek an answer. Mr. Ramsay, stumbling along a passage one dark morning, stretched his arms out, but Mrs. Ramsay having died rather suddenly the night before, his arms, though stretched out, remained empty. Chapter 4. So with the house empty, and the doors locked, and the mattresses rolled round, those stray heirs, advance guards of great armies, blustered in, brushed bare boards, nibbled and fanned, met nothing in bedroom or drawing-room that wholly resisted them, but only hangings that flapped, wood that creaked, the bare legs of tables, saucepans and china already furred, tarnished, cracked. What people had shed and left, a pair of shoes, a shooting-cap, some faded skirts and coats in wardrobes, those alone kept the human shape, and in the emptiness indicated how once they were filled and animated, how once hands were busy with hooks and buttons, how once the looking-glass had held a face, had held a world hollowed out in which a figure turned, a hand flashed, the door opened, in came children rushing and tumbling, and went out again. Now, day after day, light turned, like a flower reflected in water, its sharp image on the wall opposite. Only the shadows of the trees, flourishing in the wind, made obeisance on the wall, and for a moment darkened the pool in which light reflected itself, or birds, flying, made a soft spot flutter slowly across the bedroom floor. So loveliness reigned, and stillness, and together made the shape of loveliness itself, a form from which life had parted, solitary, like a pool at evening, far distant, seen from a train window, vanishing so quickly that the pool, pale in the evening, is scarcely robbed of its solitude, though once seen. Loveliness and stillness clasped hands in the bedroom, and among the shrouded jugs and sheeted chairs, even the prying of the wind and the soft nose of the clammy sea airs, rubbing, sniffing, iterating and reiterating their questions, "Will you fade? Will you perish?" scarcely disturbed the peace, the indifference, the air of purer integrity, as if the question they asked scarcely needed that they should answer, "We remain." Nothing, it seemed, could break that image, corrupt that innocence, or disturb the swaying mantle of silence, which, week after week, in the empty room, wove into itself the falling cries of birds, ships hooting, the drone and hum of the fields, a dog's bark, a man's shout, and folded them round the house in silence. Once only a board sprang on the landing, once in the middle of the night with a roar, with a rupture, as after centuries of quiescence, a rock rends itself from the mountain and hurtles crashing into the valley, one fold of the shawl loosened and swung to and fro. Then again peace descended, and the shadow wavered, light bent to its own image in adoration on the bedroom wall, and Mrs. McNab, tearing the veil of silence with hands that had stood in the wash-tub, grinding it with boots that had crunched the shingle, came as directed to open all windows and dust the bedrooms. Chapter 5. As she lurched, for she rolled like a ship at sea, and leered, for her eyes fell on nothing directly, but with a sidelong glance that deprecated the scorn and anger of the world, she was witless, she knew it. As she clutched the banisters and hauled herself upstairs, and rolled from room to room, she sang. Rubbing the glass of the long looking-glass, and leering sideways at her swinging figure, a sound issued from her lips. Something that had been gay 20 years before on the stage, perhaps, had been hummed and danced to, but now, coming from the toothless, bonneted, caretaking woman, was robbed of meaning, was like the voice of witlessness, humour, persistency itself, trodden down but springing up again, so that as she lurched, dusting, wiping, she seemed to say how it was one long sorrow and trouble, how it was getting up and going to bed again, and bringing things out and putting them away again. It was not easy or snug, this world she had known for close on 70 years. Bowed down she was with weariness. How long, she asked, creaking and groaning on her knees under the bed, dusting the boards, how long shall it endure? But hobbled to her feet again, pulled herself up, and again with her sidelong leer which slipped and turned aside even from her own face and her own sorrows, stood and gaped in the glass, aimlessly smiling, and began again the old amble and hobble, taking up mats, putting down china, looking sideways in the glass, as if, after all, she had her consolations, as if indeed there twined about her dirge some incorrigible hope. Visions of joy there must have been at the wash-tub, say with her children, yet two had been base-born and one had deserted her. At the public-house, drinking, turning over scraps in her drawers. Some cleavage of the dark there must have been, some channel in the depths of obscurity, through which light enough issued to twist her face grinning in the glass, and make her, turning to her job again, mumble out the old music-hall song. The mystic, the visionary, walking the beach on a fine night, stirring a puddle, looking at a stone, asking themselves, "What am I? What is this?" had suddenly an answer vouchsafed them. They could not say what it was, so that they were warm in the frost and had comfort in the desert. But Mrs. McNab continued to drink and gossip as before. Chapter 6. The spring, without a leaf to toss, bare and bright like a virgin fierce in her chastity, scornful in her purity, was laid out on fields wide-eyed and watchful, and entirely careless of what was done or thought by the beholders. Prue Ramsay, leaning on her father's arm, was given in marriage. What, people said, could have been more fitting? And, they added, how beautiful she looked. As summer neared, as the evenings lengthened, there came to the wakeful, the hopeful, walking the beach, stirring the pool, imaginations of the strangest kind, of flesh turned to atoms which drove before the wind, of stars flashing in their hearts, of cliff, sea, cloud, and sky, brought purposely together, to assemble outwardly the scattered parts of the vision within. In those mirrors, the minds of men, in those pools of uneasy water, in which clouds forever turn and shadows form, dreams persisted, and it was impossible to resist the strange intimation which every gull, flower, tree, man and woman, and the white earth itself seemed to declare, but if questioned at once to withdraw, that good triumphs, happiness prevails, order rules, or to resist the extraordinary stimulus to range hither and thither in search of some absolute good, some crystal of intensity, remote from the known pleasures and familiar virtues, something alien to the processes of domestic life, single, hard, bright, like a diamond in the sand, which would render the possessor secure. Moreover, softened and acquiescent, the spring with her bees humming and gnats dancing, threw her cloak about her, veiled her eyes, averted her head, and among passing shadows and flights of small rain, seemed to have taken upon her a knowledge of the sorrows of mankind. Prue Ramsay died that summer in some illness connected with childbirth, which was indeed a tragedy, people said. Everything, they said, had promised so well. And now, in the heat of summer, the wind sent its spies about the house again. Flies wove a web in the sunny rooms. Weeds that had grown close to the glass in the night tapped methodically at the window-pane. When darkness fell, the stroke of the lighthouse, which had laid itself with such authority upon the carpet in the darkness, tracing its pattern, came now in the softer light of spring, mixed with moonlight, gliding gently, as if it laid its caress and lingered stealthily, and looked and came lovingly again. But in the very lull of this loving caress, as the long stroke leant upon the bed, the rock was rent asunder, another fold of the shawl loosened, there it hung and swayed. Through the short summer nights and the long summer days, when the empty rooms seemed to murmur with the echoes of the fields and the hum of flies, the long streamer waved gently, swayed aimlessly, while the sun so striped and barred the rooms and filled them with yellow haze that Mrs. McNab, when she broke in and lurched about, dusting, sweeping, looked like a tropical fish oaring its way through sun-lanced waters. But slumber and sleep though it might, there came later in the summer ominous sounds like the measured blows of hammers dulled on felt, which, with their repeated shocks, still further loosened the shawl and cracked the teacups. Now and again some glass tinkled in the cupboard, as if a giant voice had shrieked so loud in its agony that tumblers stood inside a cupboard vibrated too. Then again silence fell, and then, night after night, and sometimes in plain midday when the roses were bright and light turned on the wall, its shape clearly there seemed to drop into this silence, this indifference, this integrity, the thud of something falling. A shell exploded. 20 or 30 young men were blown up in France, among them Andrew Ramsay, whose death, mercifully, was instantaneous. At that season, those who had gone down to pace the beach, and ask of the sea and sky what message they reported, or what vision they affirmed, had to consider, among the usual tokens of divine bounty, the sunset on the sea, the pallor of dawn, the moon rising, fishing boats against the moon, and children making mud pies or pelting each other with handfuls of grass, something out of harmony with this jocundity and this serenity. There was the silent apparition of an ashen-coloured ship, for instance, come, gone. There was a purplish stain upon the bland surface of the sea, as if something had boiled and bled invisibly beneath. This intrusion into a scene calculated to stir the most sublime reflections and lead to the most comfortable conclusions stayed their pacing. It was difficult blandly to overlook them, to abolish their significance in the landscape, to continue, as one walked by the sea, to marvel how beauty outside mirrored beauty within. Did nature supplement what man advanced? Did she complete what he began? With equal complacence she saw his misery, his meanness, and his torture. That dream of sharing, completing, of finding in solitude on the beach an answer, was then but a reflection in a mirror, and the mirror itself was but the surface glassiness which forms in quiescence when the nobler powers sleep beneath. Impatient, despairing yet loath to go, for beauty offers her lures, has her consolations. To pace the beach was impossible. Contemplation was unendurable. The mirror was broken. Mr. Carmichael brought out a volume of poems that spring, which had an unexpected success. The war, people said, had revived their interest in poetry. End of section 10.